This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, here we are moving into the holiday season again, and that means our annual visit with resident Christmas tree expert, Bert Craig. Bert is an associate professor in both the Michigan State University Department of Horticulture and Department of Forestry. His work is also funded in part by our good friends at MSU Ag BioResearch. Bert, it is the holiday season, and that means Christmas trees, and that means it's great to see you and welcome you back to Greening of the Great Lakes.
Always good to be here.
A big question this year, and I know you're getting a lot of this, but we've had some awful dry weather that affected a lot of our crops. How is the drought and that dry weather and then the fluctuations in temperature, any impact on the Christmas trees?
Really, the impacts have been fairly minimal. The biggest impact for the growers this year, particularly in terms of the drought and the heat that we experienced this summer, was primarily related to the new transplants. So a Christmas tree is about an 8 to 10 year crop, depending on the type of tree and the location. And so trees that are planted this year, things are going to be harvested 8, 10 years from now. So trees that were planted this year, trees that were planted last year, some growers did take some pretty hard hits on those. Probably in a lot of cases we'll need to come back and do some replanting next year to make up for that. In terms of what growers are harvesting this year and people are going to see at their stands or see at their choose and cut locations, really shouldn't be too much of an impact. Those trees were well established. They're 8 to 10 year old trees. Most cases they were able to make it through the drought okay. There were some impacts. You might see a few impacts of some of the temperature fluctuations we had in the spring, things that affected the cherry crop and the apple crop, do affect some Christmas tree species that tend to break bud early. So they'll flush, and then the new buds or the new shoots get hit back. So people that like, for instance, concolor fir or Douglas fir, you know, you might see some impacts there. It wouldn't kill the trees, but for that year, the tree's probably not saleable. The grower will need to do a little trimming, and then maybe next year they'll be back to the market.
Well, let's take our listeners through the process here. Some will be out looking for Christmas trees. So first of all, selection, and then we'll get into the care of that tree and then some of the safety factors that you like to talk about.
Yeah, sure. So, of course, the thing you want to do is you want to get the freshest tree you can. And the easiest way to do that, of course, is to cut your own. And we have lots and lots of choose and cut farms all over Michigan. Michigan Christmas Tree Association has a nice interactive map on their website. You can go on there and see a map of the state and click on and find a location nearest you. So cutting the tree yourself, you know exactly when that tree was cut and how fresh it is. If you're buying your tree from a stand, what you want to look for is making sure that the tree is fresh, that it's keeping its needles. I advise some people to do what we call the tap test. If you can kind of pick the tree up by the trunk and tap the butt end into the ground a few times, see if it's dropping any needles. If it's already dropping needles, probably time to look for another tree, because if it's already dropping needles there, that means the tree is dried out. And research has shown that once a tree is dehydrated, it's very difficult to rehydrate it. So even if you take that tree home, cut the end, stick it in water, it's probably not going to take up enough water to fully rehydrate. So the thing is getting a fresh tree and then keeping water to it. So that's really the big thing is making sure your tree is fresh. We have lots of choices here in Michigan. If you go to a tree lot or you go to a tree farm for a choose and cut, one of the sort of claims to fame for our Michigan industry is that we grow so many different types of trees. So lots of people like Fraser fir, but as I mentioned, we have other things
out.
It's
a beautiful tree.
It's a great tree.
No question about it.
And, you know, great color, great needles, great needle retention, which is always a big thing. You know, one of the things that sometimes people don't like about real trees is you know, dropping needles. And Fraser fir is one of the best in terms of needle retention. The other thing that's important for needle retention and also for safety is keeping the tree hydrated. So when you bring the tree home, if you can get it into a bucket of water, if you're not going to put it up right away, get it into a bucket of water, keep the cut in the bucket of water. Then when you're getting ready to put it up, trim off, you know, about a quarter to half inch off that cut end, and then get the tree into a stand in water. People are always amazed how much water a tree will go through, and especially when you first bring them in the house, they tend to go, the fresher the tree, the more water it's going to use. Basically, the tree doesn't know it's been cut yet, in a sense, and so they'll keep transpiring, they'll keep, you know, putting water out of those needles, and so, you know, the fresher the tree, the more water it's going to use. So we advise at least a quart of water capacity for each inch of trunk caliper. So if you look at that butt end of that tree, if it's 3 inches across, you should have a stand that should hold at least 3 quarts of water. Okay. Most stands often aren't that big, so that means you need to be checking the stand every day, okay, making sure that you're keeping water in that stand to keep the tree fresh.
My guest is Bert Craig, who's an associate professor at the Michigan State University Department of Horticulture and the Department of Forestry. He also has some extension responsibilities, but we're talking Christmas trees. Bert, I've noticed in our own trees, and we typically have a couple of them there, we do a Scotch pine and typically a Fraser fir, not to promote those necessarily, but we've been very happy with them. But boy, they do take up a lot of water initially, and you've got to be vigilant. I mean, if you let it go a day or two sometimes, I mean, they can start to dry out.
Absolutely. And again, especially when you first bring them in the house, they will suck up a lot of water. And so I always encourage people at least daily, and sometimes even a couple times a day, that first few days when they're in the house, if you've gone to choose and cut and you're bringing that tree right into your house, they get in that warm, dry air and it's almost like a straw. They will bring that water right through. And it's really critical, one, for needle retention. So if you keep the tree fresh, it's going to hang onto its needles better. And I know that's one of the things that some people don't like about real trees. But if you can keep it fresh, it's really going to help it hang on to its needles. The other big thing is in terms of safety, because we all see these various sort of horror videos that are out there that the local news like to run around Christmas time of, you know, the tree in the corner going right up in flames and all of that. And that can happen. That is a real thing. But the thing we need to bear in mind is those are trees that have been allowed to dry out. Fresh trees, again, research has shown fresh trees are very difficult to ignite. If the tree has good needle moisture with regular household sources of ignition, it's almost impossible to get a Christmas tree to ignite. Once it's dry, though, then all bets are off. That's a totally different story. So it's absolutely critical that if you're going to have a real tree, that you have a stand that holds enough water and that you keep water in that stand.
And you've been through the holiday season, you've enjoyed your Christmas tree, and now it's time to dispose of it. But there are some pretty eco-friendly ways of doing that.
Most places have Christmas tree recycling programs now where you can take usually to a park or a central location where you can drop your tree off after the holidays. What they'll do typically is bring in like a big tub grinder, and they will actually grind these things into mulch and then used in park trails or around the parks, things like that. There are some other more creative things where some communities will actually drop some of these trees into lakes and ponds where they serve like artificial reefs and fish habitat and things like that. So lots of ways of dealing with that. But certainly you want to keep the tree out of the landfill. In fact, a lot of landfills won't even take them. But make sure that you find the local recycler in your area and get that tree there.
The Michigan Christmas Tree Association and the Michigan Flower Growers are teaming up again in a campaign called Make It a Michigan Christmas. What's that all about?
Well, it's really kind of a perfect marriage. When you look at it, of course, Michigan is one of the leading Christmas tree producing states in the country. We usually rank about number three in the country in terms of total Christmas tree production. But we're also a big floriculture producing state as well. And we produce a lot of the poinsettias that go out throughout the Midwest. And so this is really sort of an ideal marriage when you think about both these things centering around the holidays. And so they've teamed up, the Michigan Christmas Tree Association and the Floral Marketing Associations have teamed up to encourage people to buy local, yep, right? So look for Michigan Christmas trees and look for Michigan-growing poinsettias. And, bring in the holidays and make it a local Michigan Christmas.
Made in Michigan.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And celebrated in Michigan as well.
Yep.
Now, Bert, is there a place folks can go for more information about Christmas tree selection and care and safety?
Yeah, absolutely. The Michigan Christmas Tree Association has a very nice website. You can Google Michigan Christmas Tree Association. And as I mentioned, they have a lot of resources on there. There's some information there about the Make It a Michigan Christmas program, as well as these interactive maps. So if you're looking for a choose and cut location, so you want to know, well, where's one nearby, you can look at that map. Most of them have directions. A little Google map will come up. They'll also list the types of trees that they carry. So if you know, for example, that you're interested in a specific type of tree, you want a Fraser fir or you want something, a balsam fir, whatever it might be, you can look on there and it'll help you decide if that has what you want or if you want a some of them have petting zoos and, of course, the whole agritainment thing, and they'll list all the different things that they have at their location.
you know, Bert, it's always great to see you because you really get us in the holiday spirit talking about Christmas trees, and really look forward to these annual visits. I've been talking with Bert Craig, who works at Michigan State University out of the Department of Horticulture and the Department of Forestry. Thanks again for sharing your expertise, and have a great holiday season.
Always good to be here. Thank you.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. Join the MSUAA family, and you're instantly connected to our network of over 500,000 Spartans in every corner of the world. Whether it's community, connections, career growth, or class, that's what the MSU Alumni Association is all about. Join the world's largest Spartan Nation community at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's a real pleasure to welcome to Greening of the Great Lakes Bill Blakemore, veteran ABC correspondent who has covered everything from the Middle East and wars and assassinations to the Vatican for many years, now is, for the last several years, been covering the issue of climate change and global warming. Bill, welcome to Greening of the Great Lakes.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Bill, first of all, your visit to Albion on Monday and Tuesday, what will you be doing there? What will you be talking with students about?
Well, folks are increasingly interested in global warming, which I suddenly discovered the gravity of all at once back in 2004 when I was on a telephone call to a scientist down in Costa Rica in his hut. I'd done a story 10 years before with him about the disappearance of amphibians around the world, and I was calling him back up to see if we could do a 10-year later story. Could he tell us why the montane amphibians, the ones who live above 3,000 feet around the world, were disappearing? And he said, well, we now have a theory. We're seeing the fingerprint of global warming. And I said, no way. And he said, oh, yes. And he sent me to two or three articles in the journal Nature, and I discovered it. So all at once, that is. I'd heard of global warming for 30 years. So anyway, I became aware of it back in 2005, and I started focusing on it immediately. And, of course, talking to students is both embarrassing and most important of all, because embarrassing because our generation has left these students, the young people, with this horrendous problem about which the world's climate scientists have no question whatsoever that it's man-made, coming fast, and a grave problem we have to solve. But also, it's always a great education for me to talk to young people, because anybody under 25 or 30 has always got this story. It's the older folks who are in the deeper denial about it. So whenever I talk to young kids, I get a different kind of question it's more deeply thought out from young folks about how are we going to deal with this, because they really, it's their generation's problem that we've left them, and I really look forward to that conversation.
I've read a number of your notebook entries, and I looked at some other things that you've done. But in the years that you've been covering climate change and global warming, have you found that the number of deniers out there or skeptics has gradually reduced over time in the wake of science? Or do you find that there's still a lot of intransigence out there?
That's such an interesting question. Actually, both. I have a good friend and colleague, Gary Langer, who runs ABC Polling, and he and other people in the polling world tell us they've done a lot of recent research that tells them that people don't necessarily really think what they often tell pollsters, even anonymous pollsters on the phone, that that, for example, they may know very well that global warming, man-made global warming, is real, but they just don't like what the solutions might be, or they have party affiliations or something. So they may tell pollsters something which is not really denial, but more a form of pushback, as Gary puts it. I think that several things are going on. There's natural denial in all of us. I mean, the psychologists tell us that we've all evolved denial as a way to keep our act together. It's a an initial denial to a really serious threat can often be a survival tactic, just to allow you to keep from falling completely apart and getting totally panicked and going into brain freeze. So what I think we've been seeing, I mean, I started covering this in 2005, and for about 5 years, we were getting on the air all the time with it, all the major broadcasts, all the networks were doing it. And then our population generally began to absorb the reality of it. And I think the relative quiet that we've seen on this subject in the last 2 years, both on the mainstream media and coming, for that matter, from the White House, although we know that's going to change very quickly, according to people very close to President Obama, this quiet, I think, has been a kind of what the psychologists call displacement activity. I think that in general, despite the, to me, unconscionable disinformation and intimidation campaign, which, according to research and academic work, is coming from some fossil fuel companies buying PR firms to confuse us, aside from all of that, I think in general what's happened is that the large majority of Americans are, like people around the world in other countries who are hearing about it, know very well that it's real. And for 4 or 5 years, between about 2005 and 2010, we absorbed the details. For the past 2 years, during which the president did not make a big issue of it, because the moment the president makes a big issue of it, it'll become a news story because it has to. I think during the past 2 years, in a general, so to speak, we've all been sort of sitting down as a nation and saying, oh my goodness, this is really big and serious. What in heaven's name are we going to do about it? It is an unprecedented problem. Journalism doesn't quite know how to cover it. No profession does, because we've never had one of these before. It's unprecedented in its scale. It's not the elephant in the room. It's the elephant we're all inside of. There's no aspect of life it doesn't cover. It's not initially, it's not basically an environment story. It's a security and finance story, and the responsible leaders around the world know this very well. They've been debating it for some years. We humans call it procrastination, and it may be a very a good thing, because what it does is it allows us to get out of the way of our own problem-solving brains, so to speak, and take a deep breath and step back. And I think that's what we've been doing for 2 years, and I think it's about to change. With a little help from Sandy, of course, which has an absolutely solid scientific basis in sea level rise, adding to its devastation.
Bill, let's hold on Sandy. We have to take a quick break, and we want to come back to Sandy and to Mayor Bloomberg's recent announcement about climate change as well. I'm talking with Bill Blakemore, a veteran ABC News correspondent, and we're talking about global warming. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Your host is Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, I'm talking climate change with Bill Blakemore, well-known and veteran correspondent of ABC News, who in recent years has been focusing on climate change and global warming. Bill, we were talking just before the break about Sandy and the evidence that those rising sea levels are having a devastating impact when storms like this arise.
Yes. In fact, there's been, as there often is, a little bit of confusion in the reporting about the man-made global warming input in the devastation of Sandy. And, of course, a lot of us who cover the global warming figured that critical mass of public awareness was going to probably be reached one way or another by the end of this summer anyway. But Sandy only gave it the final push. And the confusion in talking about the global warming element of Sandy comes from the lack of a distinction that it's important to make. There are two scientific questions about the input of global warming to the devastation of Sandy, two totally separate issues. One is sea level rise. The other is hurricanes. Now, the science on sea level rise is as solid as science ever gets and is well known and has been expected and warned about for a long time. Man-made global warming, all of the climate scientists around the world have been surveyed on this. They all completely agree that man-made global warming is responsible for the sea level rise that started only in about the year 1900, about 110 years ago. In the previous thousands of years, sea level had very little change up or down. But then in about 1900, for reasons they have solidly traced to the injection of carbon into the air from industrial activity, sea level started to rise rather steadily. And in fact, about 20 years ago, it started accelerating even more. And the scientists can connect this directly to thermal expansion of the water. As it gets warmer, it gets bigger, and so the sea level goes up, and to meltwater of land-based ice, especially from the major ice sheets that are up to 2 miles thick on top of Greenland and on top of West Antarctica. Now, because the rates of sea level rise have been estimated as up to another two or three feet by the middle of this century and up to 6 feet by the end of this century, city planners around the world, and some 15 of the 20 biggest cities in the world are on the ocean, on sea level, have all been trying to figure out what to do about it. For some years here in New York, they've been looking at the possibility of having barriers out at the Verrazano Narrows and the top of the East River and so on. The point being that what caused the damage here was, of course, the great sea surge. And whether or not hurricanes, that other question, are made more frequent or more severe by global warming, which they can't quite predict that yet, is irrelevant. There are always hurricanes every year, and they've been afraid for a long time that the hurricanes were going to come along riding on top of the rapidly rising sea level, which meant that any sea surge driven ashore by hurricanes was going to be higher and higher and higher. Inevitable. It's been reported, the projection of this has been in the press for those who wanted to look for 10 or 15 years already, and lo and behold, it happened. The science on whether man-made global warming is making hurricanes more frequent or more severe or more frequently severe is they can't quite tell yet. There's a lot of indication it may well be the case, or it may be some kind of cycle, but that's quite irrelevant to the damage question. This damage was well expected and is going to continue to get worse.
Bill, you mentioned earlier that it's been strangely quiet, maybe not strangely given the political race and all of that, but we haven't heard a lot about climate change we certainly didn't hear it in the campaign, but you said that's going to change. And you did a piece on who's responsible for climate change, for global warming, and you know, we put the United States front and center in all of this. But what are we going to hear from the White House in terms of this issue now that the election is over with? And what do you think the United States is going to do to become more aggressive, if anything?
Oh, the United States, I think, is going to do an enormous amount to become more aggressive. People who are very close to the president, news sources with whom I've been working for a long time, even before they were in the administration, have been telling us that if he got reelected, President Obama was finally going to do what a lot of them had been waiting for him to do, which was directly deal with man-made global warming as an issue. We now know the history of why that, more or less, I guess, of why that didn't happen during the Obama administration. He chose his battles. He chose health care early. They tried to get cap-and-trade legislation through and didn't, and made a political calculation not to push it as an issue because they were afraid that it would be warped and confusing in the economics concerns that they had for the nation and for also getting reelected. And he's gotten a fair amount of criticism, the president has, for having not done that. Nonetheless, whenever President Obama has spoken about man-made global warming, he's very, very strong and very clear about it. I've been told for 4 or 5 years by people close to him and by scientists who have talked to him that he gets it. He understands the gravity of the situation, but he also understands politics. And we have new evidence that he does. He managed to get reelected in a decisive victory. So that is, in the longer wavelength of this story, so to speak, somewhat encouraging to people who are activists for getting more done, because it shows that he may be more realistic about having a chance of doing it. Now, he is up against what has been well documented by professional investigative journalists and serious academics, up against a disinformation and intimidation campaign that seems to be paid for by fossil fuel companies who have hired some of the same PR firms, in some cases, who worked for Big Tobacco to try to keep people as confused as possible. And one of the structures of that was that since, for whatever reason, one of the political parties or part of it, seemed to make denial of man-made global warming an article of faith, that meant, apparently, that some of the leaders in media were intimidated into thinking that if they covered global warming not as a politics story, and it's not a politics story, political issue, but not a politics story, but covering it as an event separate from any politics, that they might appear to be partisan, since one of the parties made it an article of faith to deny it. Now, that, of course, was bound to not last for a long time sooner or later, because global warming keeps getting worse, as all of the scientists tell us it will continue to, and all the evidence shows. And so it seems that this rear guard action by the fossil fuel companies, which is what it is described by the investigative journalists as being, an action to try to prevent regulation, a price on carbon, whatever form it takes, as long as possible, knowing it'll eventually come, is having to constantly shift ground. In fact, recently the CEO of ExxonMobil admitted openly on a public forum at the Council on Foreign Relations, well, we know that it's man-made, but we'll be able to adapt. And, of course, a great deal of criticism came from him saying that. So the indications we're getting from people close to the president, who, when he does speak about it, especially the young people, is very clear and strong about it, and he made a very clear statement about it also in his victory speech in Chicago, that our children's life is greatly threatened by, or however, I forget the exact words, by the warming planet, and we have to deal with that. They're promising people who have asked them, they're saying to us that he will be dealing with it much more directly now. And the world, by the way, at the international negotiations for the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change that happen every year, has been waiting for America to take a lead on this. And recently at the last climate summit in Durban, South Africa, that I was at last year, very prominent European leaders, to my surprise, were willing to go on camera with me and say, we don't look to America for leadership anymore. We look to China for leadership on how we're going to solve global warming. Now, we have every reason to think that they know that won't last, and that President Obama is committed to coming out and dealing directly with this problem, and with the fossil fuel company resistance, if he runs into any, and making it an issue and a conversation in this country. We do expect that.
A couple of the messages that you will have for the students at Albion when you're down there, because they're going to look for your perspective on things, but what are a couple of take-home messages that you might leave those students with during your visit?
Well, forgive me for saying this, but the first thing I'll say is that I don't, as a professional journalist, of course, I don't do messages, except on one subject, and that is excellent journalism. I mean, I'm very consciously not an advocate for stopping global warming or slowing it down 1 second or saving a single species. Of course, I don't want bad things to happen. I do want good things to happen. But my job as a professional journalist is I'm just trying to figure out how to report global warming, not how to stop it. And, of course, when you stop and think about it, that's, of course, what you want from a professional journalist, is somebody who's going to keep trying to add perspective to the story and bring interesting information, which is known as news. And so my first, the only message, so to speak, as a message that I give, which is the only one proper for me as a professional journalist to give, is look for the people who you really trust as reporters. That's the word here, honest reporters. Our job is to give fair and accurate. And by the way, not the word balance is not initially part of our professional promise. It's a subset of a subset of a subset of fair. We're always trying to add perspective and be fair and not misleading and accurate. So that's the first thing I'm going to say is to students, that I always say is, you know, listen to people who you believe are doing the hardest skeptical work they can. I'm a professional skeptic, always examining and thinking about things. And then of course, once having made that clear, that it's important to point out that I'm very consciously not an activist, and in my case, I don't have any party affiliation either. Not that I couldn't be a good journalist if I did. It's a matter of being open about that if you do, but I don't happen to. After that, because it's in Michigan where I have some deep roots, I mean, western Michigan, north of Muskegon and south of Ludington on those beautiful sand dunes is the place our family has gone for four generations and is the one spot on the planet that I care most deeply about as a place in those beautiful wooded sand dunes with lakes and orchards and streams. And it's where my own biophilia, my own natural affinity to nature, was awakened as a kid on a little stream that I still visit in my mind every day. I'll be talking about biophilia, I think, and the psychologies of global warming and how the natural instincts of their youth, and especially in Michigan, is something that I resonate to and that they have an enormous amount to protect. One other last thought there. One of the points I like to make is that as long as a disinformation or intimidation campaign is going on from what appears to be one of the parties more to the right, a very important element in the true global warming debate is missing. And that's what I would say is it would appear to us, to me as a journalist and a number of other journalists who cover this, that what's really missing in how to deal with man-made global warming has been a strong and vigorous conservative or Republican voice and perspective. And I expect that will come along pretty soon, as everybody generally acknowledges we've got a situation on our hands.
I've been talking with Bill Blakemore, veteran ABC news correspondent and expert in the coverage of global warming. Bill, thanks so much for being on Greening of the Great Lakes.
It's an honor and a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's a great pleasure to welcome to the show John Allen, newly appointed director of the Office of the Great Lakes, which is a key arm of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, with responsibility to preserve and protect our Great Lakes. John, it was always a pleasure to have your predecessor, Patty Burkholz, on this program, and now it's a great pleasure to welcome you to Greening in the Great Lakes.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here. Patty has served Michigan well, and I think she served in her office well, and it's a big big shoes to fill as we move on. So we have to give a lot of credit to Patty for her service to the state.
Well, for those who may have missed those earlier interviews with Patty, a little bit of an overview for our listeners on the Office of the Great Lakes. I mean, what are your major responsibilities, mission, and goals?
Well, the office was formed to be a central voice for the preservation, protection, and use and enjoyment of the Great Lakes within the state of Michigan. They are iconic. They define us. They define the people of Michigan. We are the Great Lakes State. Both the Great Lakes themselves and all the groundwater and streams that feed the Great Lakes. So it is this unifying voice. It's not a regulatory agency. It's a policy agency, and it advocates both within the state for the things that we just mentioned and really also so centralizes the voice of Michigan and the department and the governor's voice with his colleagues around the basin, too. So it really works in concert with the eight other states. You can't manage and protect and understand this resource without doing it without the other eight states or seven states in the basin and our two partners in Canada, the provinces, Ontario and Quebec. So it tries to put all that together in a way that makes sense and really looks to the health and integrity of the lakes over time.
Well, your background, fisheries and wildlife at Michigan State University, also biology, a little bit for our listeners about how you come to this office, John, and your vision for the office as moving forward.
Well, I've spent my early career, my academic career in the sciences, so I see myself in scientific terms or empirical terms. Mm-hmm. As I said, I did my undergraduate in fisheries and wildlife, principally around environmental education, and then a master's degree in zoology. I did spend some time also working towards a PhD at Michigan State in environmental policy and law. After that, I spent a number of years, 20 years or so, nearly 20 years at Consumers Energy, working through a variety of different environmental types of positions there, and spent a lot of time on Great Lakes issues during all that time. So we bring in some experience and some time dealing with Great Lakes issues. I mean, our vision for the office is to continue the good work that, that Tracy Meehan has done and Ken DeBozar did and then Patty did in their 10 years through the office, and to make sure that Michigan has a very strong voice in issues that matter on the Great Lakes, both in the state and around the basin.
Well, clearly Michigan has had a strong voice, and no issue has that been more apparent than with all the talk in the last few years about invasive species in general and the Asian carp in particular. A little bit about invasive species, very difficult, knotty issues that go back for many decades. But the Asian carp thing is the one that's front and center.
It is. Asian carp, I think, has captured people's minds and imaginations and seen invasive species for the threat that they are to the Great Lakes. It is only one of many species that are both either imminent into the Great Lakes or already in the Great Lakes. Great Lakes, I believe, have 180 some species already in them. Those are the ones that we have to understand and manage, minimize the effects as they're here. Many of them will never find a way, or at least in the short term, will never find a way to get them out, whether it's Phragmites or zebra mussel or quagga, rough, some of the fish species and other things. What we have to really do is be as diligent as we can to make sure we're keeping the ones that aren't here out. Mm-hmm. And whether that's in particular the Asian carp, which we see as potentially devastating to the Great Lakes, and the tributaries, especially in some of the spawning habitats that they might do very well in. So we have to work with all due speed to make sure that we're bringing everything to bear to prevent those from coming in, which is as much a problem of separating the Mississippi Basin from the Great Lakes Basin, putting the controls and the protections, barriers in place there. But it's also about organisms in trade, other ways, and then also on ballast water. We can't only focus on the one and then have a sieve, for instance, on the other side as things could potentially move in. So it's really a balanced approach that we have to look at all the ways that invasive species could enter the basin.
Well, I know you're new in the position. There's a much-anticipated Army Corps of Engineer report that's going to be coming out, I think, in the next couple of years that is going to provide at least the Army Corps' solution to this Asian carp problem. Any news on that as far as you of late?
Well, we're just hoping and demanding that the Army Corps work with all due speed. The sooner that report gets out, the better. We're working with the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General has been front and center on this issue, obviously, working with the other states and in pursuit of diligence on behalf of the federal government to make sure that this issue is deeply attended to. We can't think about a solution after the problem enters, right? Now is the time.
And we've got big problems.
And we have to work. We have to work with all speed, and we're really expecting the Corps to produce what they're expected to legally. And we're going to make sure that that's done in a timeline that we can be responsive to the threat as we see it.
Yeah, and the one thing that's so good about that is this really represents a bipartisan effort. And this is actually what's good for the state of Michigan, what's good for the Great Lakes, and it's encouraging to see that bipartisan effort. I'm talking with John Allen, who is the director of the Office of the Great Lakes. When Greening the Great Lakes continues, let's talk about some of the other initiatives in your office, including the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative and the Great Lakes Compact.
You're listening to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Your host is Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, my guest is John Allen, who's the director of the Office of Great Lakes, which is a key arm of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. John, we're talking about what a treasure our Great Lakes are, and we don't need to tell our listeners that, and the role your office plays in preserving that treasure. The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative has been a very good thing for the Great Lakes, and again, represents some bipartisan support at both the federal and the state levels. Where are we with the Great Lakes Initiative? What are some of the key programs that your office is involved in, funded by the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative?
Great, sure. The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative grew out of this out of a program called the Great Lakes Regional Collaborative. I mean, these were great ideas to try to bring pressure and resources to bear on what had historically been legacy issues for the Great Lakes, in particular Michigan's area of concern, these 14 areas that had been designated since the 70s, essentially, as needing particular attention on cleanups and habitat restoration and a variety of other things. So Michigan has made really stellar progress over the last couple of years in particular because Congress allocated the kinds of resources necessary to address these. I think there's been roughly $300 million a year over the last couple of years allocated to this effort. That money then flows through the Environmental Protection Agency and out to the states through our office, in some cases, not all of it, obviously, and then out to people in communities that are doing in the important work of restoring what had been long histories of legacy contamination. And that contamination was either sediments or habitat loss or things that related to beach closures. So there has been diligent work, and I really want to give a lot of the credit for the work in the communities to the PACs, these citizen groups that have dedicated, in some cases, 2 and 3 decades of their life to diligence around cleaning up either legacy contamination, sediment contamination, and doing their habitat work. These folks, I was just at a meeting the other day with the estate PAC, and was just so impressed by the passion of individuals within communities and the work that they've done. So, yes, the Office of Great Lakes participates in that, and our staff is deeply committed and diligent, but it's really about individuals and people driving the work in their community, identifying what projects needed to be done, identifying where habitat needs to get restored, identifying where and how sediment needs to come out, working with consultants to do that, and just starting to do the hard work one after the next after the next.
And here's a case, despite all the bashing sometimes that federal funding gets, I mean, this is a case where that money is actually being used to empower citizens, to further empower citizens who are already organized, who are already working on behalf of those areas of concern. And now there are some resources that can just sort of ramp up that enthusiasm.
The types of work that we're talking about is expensive. Removing contaminated sediments, disposing of them properly is expensive work. Habitat restoration at the coast, wetlands restoration, beachfront restoration, softening, you know, what had historically been hardened infrastructure, and then putting access points in for people to go and enjoy the resources are all critical work. Communities know best how they want their communities to be right. And to look. They want them to be healthy. They want them to be reflective. And the best folks that know how to do that are the folks that work in the PACs, in these advisory groups. And the enablement of the federal money to do that at scale has meant that we've been able to make really stellar progress in communities around Michigan. It's been pretty spectacular what's happened over the last couple of years.
Yeah, one that's been in the news recently specifically is the up in Muskegon County, I guess, White Lake. It's becoming ever closer to total environmental recovery, and that was a lake that was pretty much devastated.
White Lake is a great example. The organizations in and around White Lake and the Office of Great Lakes and many other partners have been diligently working there, and we hope that there's some good news on the horizon in terms of an announcement. Michigan has not been able to delist one of these 14 areas of concern yet. You know, since the program started early on in the 70s and then really as named AOCs or areas of concern in the 80s, we're getting very close, hopefully over the next 12 to 18 months, that we'll be able to have some of these great sort of celebratory moments.
Well, be sure and let us know on Greening the Great Lakes when one of those moments occurs, and we can help you publicize that, because that would be wonderful.
We and the communities will let everybody know. These are going to be important moments for Michigan.
I'm talking with John Allen, who's the director of the Office of the Great Lakes. Let's talk a little bit about the Great Lakes Compact. What is the Great Lakes Compact, and again, how does that tie in with these other initiatives?
This is a great question. This is another very high priority for the office and for Michigan and for the region. So the compact was an agreement struck between 8 states and then an ancillary or related agreement with the 2 provinces, because the provinces could not sign a U.S. compact with the states. So it is an agreement on managing the water of 20% of the world's fresh water, yes, of the Great Lakes. And it was a spectacular agreement. It was really pretty monumental. Hard fought, hard negotiated, took a long time, but by the mid-2000s, 2006, I believe, had the agreement in place. And what it does is, for the first time, put in place a set of standards or criteria along which we're going to look at the withdrawal of water at scale or large measure and or the potential for diversions of water out of the Great Lakes. previous to that, we had two laws. Michigan had two laws. One was a federal law that says diversions were banned, and a Michigan law that said diversions were banned. But both of those laws came without standards. So the considered opinion at the time was, even though Michigan had a ban on diversions, without a standard, without a way to know how to make a decision, that might not be a durable mechanism legally. So what happened, the compact is essentially that durable mechanism. What did we collectively agree to? What are the standards by which we judge projects or withdrawals from the Great Lakes, large-scale withdrawals, in pursuit of the protection of the Great Lakes, but also still looking at the use and enjoyment thereof? Mm-hmm. Those are important sort of collateral principles.
For those who may worry about this whole issue of diversion, particularly to other parts of the United States, and as you know, that's been much in the news over the last few years, what does it take now under the compact to have any diversion like that occur? Is it a unanimous vote of the members of the compact? What is the policy that allows for any diversion to occur?
Well, the state in which the diversion is proposed will need to come forth and with great detail, make their case. Mm-hmm. And they essentially have to make the case to the other states. And the other states then have the opportunity under the standards as written to decide if they believe it does or doesn't meet the standards, as opposed to just saying yes or no. There's a set of criteria against which they can, you know, whether it's protective of the resource, whether there's return flow back into the basin, whether that return flow comes back in a quality mm-hmm. that's necessary to support, you know, a healthy system. So this set of criteria then gets measured. So the compact was never about a way to say no in every case necessarily. It's a way to say yes, but under these conditions.
And based on scientific.
And based on good, sound scientific conditions related to the health, the ecological integrity, and the health of the water and water-dependent natural resources of the Great Lakes, as it's written.
John, I want to ask you to put your scientist hat on here for a minute, but a lot of folks are concerned about lake levels right now. I mean, that's also part of the buzz. And I know you follow the lake level thing. Historically, it's been cyclical, as you know.
Right.
Lake levels are down. Some homeowners are concerned. We have a place in Sutton's Bay. We're a little bit concerned, quite frankly. What is the whole deal now with lake levels? Is it cyclical? Is this something that we need to be concerned about? Your view as a scientist.
Well, I think both of those statements you just made are true. They are cyclical. We've seen great evidence. Now, you know, looking for cycles in nature is always a little bit complicated, but we think the lakes are on fairly significant cyclical basis. We are, I believe, in Lake Michigan and Huron, which are really hydrologically one unit.
Right.
They're connected, are roughly within a couple of inches. Last time I looked, they were within 2 inches of their historic low, and that historic low happened around 1964.
Right.
Now, if you remember 1985, they were at some of their historic highs, and beach owners and homeowners were worried because houses were actually falling into
exactly.
the lake because
just
of erosion. So we've had some pretty major cycles. The lakes are largely dominated by the amount of water that comes in, right? It's precipitation and the amount of water that goes out, and that's all really dominated by the evaporative cycle. So things like ice cover matter, a lot of water evaporates off the surface of a lake in the winter when it's cold and dry. A lot of water just evaporates up into that, and without ice cover, you can lose a lot
right.
of water. And if there's no snow in the winter to replenish those, or rain in the spring or the summer, lake levels go down. So we have seen these long cycles. Whether that's also exacerbated by water leaving through the St. Clair River has been postulated, or whether that's also exacerbated by large-scale climatological change, I think there's some theories and some probabilities, but we just need to keep looking at them. Where it's really starting to show up, as you said, at the water, it's showing up in harbors. It's showing
right.
up in recreational harbors. And we're concerned about that. We understand how that can affect local communities and boaters and homeowners on the Great Lakes. So how much of this is within natural variability? How much of this has additional human-induced functions is a little hard to tease out. The reality is that it's affecting individuals and people and business and trade. It's also affecting the amount of grain or ore or materials that boats can carry. As the water levels go down, the channels are only certain deep. Boats have certain amount of draft. They have to lighten up so they don't, run aground in the channel. So we know that that's also affecting trade on the Great Lakes.
John, we just got a few seconds here left, but as the new director of the Office of the Great Lakes, any final words that you'd like our listeners to know about what the Office of Great Lakes is going to be doing in the near term and things that that you're most concerned about?
Well, I'd like to just mention, we think about the world in sort of three ways. One is really fundamental, what drives the ecological integrity, what really drives the health of the Great Lakes system. That's from, you know, coastal habitat and water balance and water quality and species management, those things. What really drives the health of the lakes? If the lakes are healthy and functioning as they need to be, then that's the right base. If you look on top of that, what are the human use and enjoyment from those lakes, whether it's looking at them, the aesthetics, whether it's walking the beaches, whether it's fishing, whether it's using water, either from groundwater or surface water, in the pursuit of drinking. 100% of Michigan residents drink water from the Great Lakes, either from groundwater or surface, and those are important. And then commerce and industry around the use side, ecological principles, health of the lakes first, human use and enjoyment. And then the real last piece, I think the fundamental way we look at it is, how do people see themselves relative to the lakes? It's about placemaking. It's about community. How do I connect? You talked about Sutton's Bay, mm-hmm. and I heard in your voice when you said that, that there was an emotion, yeah. Right? You're emotionally Absolutely. Attached to that yeah. place. Mm-hmm. So it's about the ecological health, the human use and enjoyment, and really essentially our love of place, affinity. How do we see ourselves in the water? How do we see our reflection in the healthy water of the Great Lakes?
And the Great Lakes are part and parcel of who we are, most of us, and it's deeply embedded within our psyche and in our hearts. And wishing you all the best moving forward, John, in terms of managing the office at the Great Lakes.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure being here.
I've been talking with John Allen, who is the new director of the Office of the Great Lakes, which is housed in the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Please find us on Facebook by searching for Greening of the Great Lakes and follow us on Twitter at Green Michigan.
Please visit Greening of the Great Lakes online at mlive.com/environment.
Turn it up, turn it up, a little bit higher. Radio, turn it up, burn it up, so you know, radio.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.